Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Crypto. This episode is part of our guest series. And with me today, I have Chris Winfrey, co-founder of Authereum, a browser-based Ethereum wallet. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For the people that want to know Chris's background, we'll get to that in the end. With This Week in Crypto, I'd like to get directly to the contents. So Chris, can you tell us about Authereum and what it is?
Sure. So Authereum is a dApp login solution and wallet. And so what we're looking to do is get Ethereum in as many people's hands as possible by removing a lot of these barriers to get onboarded onto decentralized applications.
Can you tell me about, we'll jump into different types of wallets, but can you tell me about the Authereum experience? Everything from signing up, loading a balance to sending a transaction. What's the process like?
So we've worked really hard to kind of abstract away the crypto part of decentralized applications and give users something that feels as familiar as possible, but while remaining non-custodial and censorship resistant and staying true to kind of our core values and core values across this ecosystem. When a user starts with a new dApp, they can sign up with just a username and password, just like they would with a normal everyday application. They immediately have a wallet and then they can add some crypto from a different wallet that they already have, or they can just purchase crypto with a debit card through our wire integration. And then they're immediately able to start interacting with applications. And then we've abstracted away gas. So the user doesn't need to think about how expensive the transactions are or you know, what gas fee they should put. They're just transacting and then they see the transaction fees come out of their account. We've put stable coins at the forefront, specifically DAI, so that way for new users, they can just transact in a US dollar denominated way. Their transaction fees can be paid with DAI, and they don't need to touch Ether unless they want to. And that can be subbed out for any token. You know, if they'd rather transact in a token paid to euros, they can do that, or one of the other stable coin, US dollar stable coins. That's also an option. We've also taken steps on the security side to enable transactions to be automatically approved. So that way, you know, makes all of these interactions very simple to do. They just are transacting it and they don't have to like get the pop-up and set their gas fee and then approve it. It feels a lot more like a Web2 application.
Great. So for sign up, it's a password, username, and email.
Mm-hmm.
And then for sending crypto, people can... It's not custodial, so they can manage their own crypto, send their own crypto. And you also have integrations to access other cryptos?
So we're strictly Ethereum-based right now. In the future, that might change. But right now, we're focused on Ethereum because that seems to be where dApps are being built. And you know, what we're catering towards is you know, the decentralized applications. And so you can use any asset that's built on Ethereum or Ether.
Great. So all ERC-20 tokens. Then you have an integration to buy Ether?
Yeah, Ether, or you can get onboarded directly to DAI, which is actually what the experience that we'd like to push more new users towards. Because I really think it's a lot easier for users to understand something that's denominated in US dollars. They can kind of get onboarded directly to that, you know, lend it out and start to realize the value of using Ethereum and decentralized applications before taking the steps to understand, you know, what is like a cryptocurrency, why is it volatile, what makes the price change, and that is actually a barrier to using this stuff.
So can you tell me a little more about the user-friendly side and what makes Ethereum more user-friendly?
So one of the main differences between us and a lot of what's offered today is that we're using a contract-based account. So instead of holding your funds with just a public address that you have a private key that basically can do any kind of action with that account, you hold your funds in a smart contract, and then you have different keys that are across different devices and have different permissions to access and transact with the funds in your smart contract account. And so obviously we want to keep things super simple. We don't use the word key in the interface. The user, all of this is abstracted away from the user, but this is kind of how it works under the hood and how we're able to make these UX improvements that just aren't possible on what we call an externally owned account, where it's just a public address and a private key. And so those improvements, you know, one of them is we use meta transactions. And so with a meta transaction, you know, all these keys that surround your account don't hold any funds. And so therefore, they can't pay for the gas to make transactions themselves. So what we do is we have those keys sign the transaction data. And then that signature can be used to show the smart contract that this key is able to interact on, you know, on the user's behalf. And so we can take that signature and then send that over to what we call a relayer. And then the relayer makes the actual on-chain transaction. And this has a nice side effect in that, you know, the relayer is paying Ether, and then the user needs to refund the relayer for their service. That refund can now be in any token. So the user doesn't just have to pay their transaction fees in Ether. They could pay their transaction fees in DAI, or if they're using a dApp that has its own token, they could just, you know, strictly interact with that dApp's token and not have to worry about obtaining Ether and that token or and DAI. So that's one big improvement is that, you know, we can kind of, you know, what we call, you know, this also enables what we call the DAI first experience, where the user gets onboarded directly to DAI and they can start interacting and they only have DAI in their account. They don't have Ether. And I think that's really powerful, especially for new users. And then the other thing we can do with contract-based accounts is batch transactions. With a normal account, if you're interacting with multiple smart contracts, which is really common with these decentralized applications, to the user, that's, you know, they don't need to understand that. But today, there's often a single action that's taken by the user that interacts with different smart contracts, which means they need to send out multiple transactions in sequence, which is hard for them to understand because they're not aware of these low-level details. So that will kind of look like, okay, you know, I go to Uniswap, which is a decentralized exchange. And if I want to trade with a new token, I first need to unlock that token or approve it, which is one action, wait for a block confirmation, and then I can swap and wait for another block confirmation. With Ethereum integrated, we can batch those transactions, which means we can just make it a single on-chain transaction that either fails or succeeds as a single transaction. And then that way we can completely abstract away from the user the idea of like approval or unlocking so that they don't even have to think about it. It doesn't need to show up in the user face. They can just hit swap and not have to understand these low-level details of the smart contract.
Great. So you explained quite a bit there about Ethereum structure, and the core of it, I think, is contract-based accounts. So you mentioned a few benefits. One is the gas spectrum network and how you create a DAI first experience. We'll jump into that. But then the other one was the structure sets a level of permissions. Can you tell me a little bit more about contract-based accounts in general? How do they compare to something like a multi-sig account? Then we'll jump into how it works in Ethereum.
Sure. So in implementation, contract-based accounts are very similar to multi-sig accounts in that they are a smart contract that holds funds, and then there's multiple keys that are able to transact on behalf of, you know, or transact for the contract. But contract-based accounts, you know, from the user's perspective, are a little different in that it belongs to a single user, and whereas a multi-sig, I've heard them used interchangeably, but usually a multi-sig is multiple users that are controlling a shared set of funds.
Can you tell me about the contract-based account structure on Ethereum? So essentially, every wallet is a contract-based account. Part of how Ethereum works with different apps is levels of permission with the admin key, which we'll talk about, and the dApp key. So can you tell me about what is the admin key, what is the dApp key, and what are the levels of permission?
So we have two types of keys, and this is a core piece of our architecture. Again, the user doesn't need to understand any of this, which is why, you know, I think these concepts are so powerful, is that, you know, it's all abstracted away. But under the hood, we have admin key, which is kind of like your private key for a normal account. It has full access to your account, and it's kind of the one that you want to protect the most. And then with your admin key, you can approve dApp keys. And so your dApp keys are what you're actually using to interact with different applications. And with dApp keys, we can permission them, meaning we can allow for a certain whitelist of smart contracts, or we can put spending limits on them. We can scope them to specific domains. And that provides a much more secure experience when interacting with a decentralized application, because your main key isn't as exposed to the application. Also, what we've done is allowed for dApp keys to be created completely off-chain. And so it's really important for users to be able to kind of log into different and log out of different decentralized applications without making an on-chain transaction, waiting for a block time, and paying a fee every time they log in. So what we've done is with your admin key, you can create an off-chain signature that acts as an attestation that says that this dApp key is allowed to transact with this contract. And then from the user perspective, they just log into Ethereum, and under the hood, the dApp key is created, it's signed, and is ready to be used. And they just see it as an instant login, just like they were logging in with Google or any kind of Web2 style login.
So let's go back to the beginning of signing up for an Ethereum account. You explained the sort of the user onboarding experience. Let's discuss about under the hood. So when a user signs up via email, password, and their username, it generates a contract-based account. What happens there? Where is the admin key? How is it created? Where is it stored?
Yeah, so we wanted to make it as smooth as possible for that initial onboard and for the user to kind of realize some value from the decentralized applications before they have to take the steps to like really secure their account. And they don't really need to do that until there's actual value in the account. So with contract-based account, when they sign up, the contract gets deployed. And at the beginning, I mentioned, you know, being censorship resistant and non-custodial are core values of ours. So the admin key gets created in the user's hands. So it gets created client side. It gets encrypted immediately, stored in the user's browser. And then we also store an encrypted copy of that key store on our server. And it's encrypted with the user's password, which we don't know. We never see the user's password in plain text, and we'll never be able to access this key store and decrypt it. But what that lets us do is when a user signs into a different device, or they, you know, clear the storage on a device and then re-log in, they can download this encrypted key store and decrypt it with their password and start using Ethereum. And it's very seamless from their perspective.
And so how Ethereum is different is let's compare MetaMask. With MetaMask, you download a browser extension, you set up your account, you use it. But it's specific to that specific machine in that browser. If you want to use another browser, you're going to have to import your password, or even I believe you have to import your private key. What makes Ethereum different, as you're saying, is you can use your username and password to log in from any device. You don't have to authorize any new device.
Exactly. You just log in with the username and password, and you're ready to start using that new device.
So what makes that possible is the fact that there is a key, it's a key store file that's stored on the Ethereum side, which is encrypted. Can you tell me a little bit more about where is that stored? Is it a server?
So we store a copy in the browser, and then we also encrypted, and then also an encrypted copy on our server. And then we allow the user to also store an encrypted copy in a decentralized way through our 3Box integration. So that way, you know, we want to make sure that if Ethereum ever stops existing, or, you know, becomes malicious, or, you know, the user doesn't rely on us to use their account, they're always able to access it without us. And so that's one of the steps we've taken to make that possible.
And I think that's a key highlight of what makes this such a unique wallet. Why I like it a lot is that you can sign up on a desktop, you can go on your mobile browser and just transact with the browser itself. You don't have to wait for a recovery or authorization period to use the application.
And so another thing that this enables, which a lot of people don't realize yet, is that we're enabling native apps as well. So today, without that kind of account portability that's enabled by Ethereum, we basically don't see mobile apps in crypto. And that's because you would either need to, you know, spin up a new seed phrase and a new account on each of your mobile apps, seed those with funds to pay for their transactions, which is just a really clumsy experience compared to using like a crypto browser or something. And even the crypto browser is like not a great experience. You know, users just want to use their normal browser. And so in the traditional world, we use apps, iOS apps, Android apps in our day-to-day life all the time. And this is the reason we haven't seen it in crypto yet. But with Ethereum, dApp developers will be able to make native apps. Users can just log into those apps with their Ethereum account. It's the same account that they have on their desktop and their mobile browsers. And this will kind of open up the world of native crypto apps.
So let's talk about Ethereum's sort of business model per se. Of course, the wallet is meant for end users, but you have this developer focus tool set. An idea for Ethereum is to make it integratable with many different apps and applications. So would you compare Ethereum to something like PayPal, where it's something that merchants can integrate without having to build out their own wallet service?
Yeah, I would say in that aspect, it's very similar. Obviously, within crypto, everything kind of has its own spin on it. So like we do have this like wallet interface, and then you can log into the applications and not just pay for stuff like you would with PayPal, but actually transact in a back and forth kind of way, where you might be lending, you might be swapping assets, you'd be doing like a whole like a much broader set of transactions.
Talking about the industry as a whole and the types of wallets that exist, what would you say that Ethereum is trying to replace MetaMask?
So I would say in some sense, yes. But, I think what we're trying to do is make it so that the user doesn't need to have an extension or a specialized app to use these decentralized applications, and more have the login just be built right into the application so they can just use it on a desktop, they can use it on mobile, they can use it as a native app. And then in some ways, stuff like MetaMask is very complementary because if you have a MetaMask account, you have a Ledger or Gnosis Safe, you can add that account as a recovery method for your Ethereum account.
So you mentioned recovery. That's obviously a major factor when having a wallet. Different companies have different options for recovery. One of the really popular mechanisms for recovery was having a multi-sig account, where if you lose your key, somebody else can save it for you. So tell me a little bit about how recovery works on Ethereum.
Sure. So the user gets onboarded and they create their account. And then once they've started to use their account, they have some value in it, then we start asking them to add a recovery method. And so that recovery method, it could just be a seed phrase, especially if they're a new user and they don't have other accounts, they don't have a hardware device, that is a good option. But they can wait till, maybe they're back at home. If they signed up on their mobile phone when they were out with friends or something, wait till it's the right time to back up that seed phrase. And then they can also add a Ledger, they could add a MetaMask, like I already mentioned. And then we're working on social recovery or multi-sig recovery, depending on how you think about it, where you can actually specify multiple devices that need to sign off on triggering the recovery process. And then in the future, we'll also implement time delayed recovery. And so the advantage of that is that you can start to add your friend or even Ethereum as a service to recover your account. And because that's on a time delay, if you do still have control of your account, you can always cancel that recovery process if it was triggered in a malicious way or in an accidental way. And that way, it remains non-custodial, or that your friend can't just take over your account. But then you kind of have that backup where if you do lose your access to your account, then you can trigger the recovery process. After a few weeks, then you're back and have access to your account again.
So to recap the recovery methods, the first one would be the traditional way of just saving a private key. You can obviously view it. The access to the account is via username and password. So essentially, if the user forgets their password, they lose access to the account.
But then if they have a recovery method, then they can recover it even if they lost their password.
Got it. So once you have value in the account, you want to set up your recovery. And then, so the first one is save a private key. Another one is use something like a hardware device. Can you tell me a little bit about how that works?
Mm-hmm. So it would be as simple as just plugging in your hardware device and adding it as a recovery method. And then you're good to go. You can put your ledger back in whatever safe spot you keep it in or whatever your hardware device you're using. So it will be a very straightforward process.
So is that similar to sort of like a multi-sig? You authorize the hardware device to the account. Then later on, if you do need to recover it, you can sign a transaction with that hardware device and it'll recover it.
Exactly.
But talking about email, I think that's an important thing. I haven't seen email as a part of crypto wallet. This is part of your strategy, I guess, to be Web2 and something that's very familiar with users, which is very easy. But at the compromise of that comes concerns about security. Are there security risks when a user's email is compromised?
So there isn't, and we use email as a way to notify the user, but it isn't a part of the authentication. So if your email was compromised, that doesn't help the attacker get into your account. And then if you lose access to your email account, that doesn't have anything to do with losing access to your Ethereum account. So you can think of the username as one, you can use it as like to, you know, log in with your email and password or your username and password. But having access to that email address doesn't help you or hurt you in terms of, getting authenticated, and access to your account.
Got it. So traditionally, if somebody has a Coinbase account, the way that their Coinbase account would be compromised via email is through a forget password reset. So essentially with Ethereum, there is no forget password reset. You have to use a different method. Is that how that works?
Yeah, you can think of the recovery methods as your password reset. So it's like a password reset, but you need to have access to whatever recovery method that you set up.
Got it. So it's definitely good to clear that. I think a lot of people would be concerned about email, especially with something that's common with exchanges. Moving back to talking about other wallets, can you tell me how Ethereum compares to some of the other wallets in the works? One of the popular ones is Argent.
I think Argent's a little different than some of the wallets that we consider a little closer to what we're doing. I would say Argent has done an awesome job. We really like their team. Their app is beautiful, and really happy with what they're doing. And I think Argent's more focused on asset management. So you download the app, you hold your crypto in the app and you can, you know, exchange it. You can access different set of DeFi protocols and then, you know, kind of send and receive through the app. And so with Ethereum, we're more focused on the key management and being a login solution. So any dApp can integrate Ethereum without our permission, and Ethereum users will immediately be able to start using that dApp. And so I think that's a key difference, is that we're kind of like the login solution, and you know, the dApp developers are building out the actual experience for the user. And then there's some other solutions like Portis. There's MetaMask and Fortmatic and you know, so those are a little closer to what we're doing. That they're also login solutions and wallets. And I think the key difference there is that we're using contract-based accounts versus externally owned accounts, and really pushing forward what you can do with these contract-based accounts and getting those advantages into the user's hands.
Got it. So for the integrations with Ethereum, your tagline is log into Ethereum. So to make this easier to understand, if Uber wants to accept crypto, they can integrate an Ethereum wallet and login solution to be able to do that. Is that sort of an example?
Yeah, definitely. The payment example is like probably the most simple form of what someone would use Ethereum for, or even just authentication. Like you could use Ethereum as a login solution without actually making on-chain transactions and that kind of thing. So like you could have a forum or something where people log in with a Ethereum based account and are able to comment and stuff, but nothing is actually going on chain. You can do payments, and then you can do like what we're really focused on, which is like the, you know, interacting with decentralized applications that have some kind of smart contract system as part of their backend.
Can you tell me a little bit about how some of these other wallets work? I'm not too familiar how Tortoise or Taurus works in terms of its structure. Can you provide some context to how they are structured?
Yeah. So Portis, they have a private key, and the portability of that private key is very similar to what we're doing with the portability of the auth key for Ethereum. But then you just transact with that key to make transactions with the dApps. So there's no smart contract or relay or any of the complexity there. And then same with Fortmatic in that, it's just a externally owned account where it's just private key, public address. But what they do is that they're using secure hardware and kind of storing your private key on the secure hardware and then, doing authentication with the user to allow them access to make transactions there.
And now moving on to integrations, getting back to that DAI first experience. This is something that's very exciting. So essentially, a user can sign up to Ethereum and it's just DAI, a stablecoin, something they understand, something that's not volatile. And what makes this different is that the user is able to send transactions without having to have ETH, which is something that's traditionally required. Can you tell me about the gas station spectrum concept, how it works, a little bit of its history and how Ethereum is using it?
Yeah, I think you touched on a few things there. So we had the DAI first experience, and users can pay their transaction fees in DAI. And then we've also taken steps to kind of remove that extra thing that the user needs to think about when they're making transactions, which is what gas price they want to choose. So traditionally, this has been given to the user because it's an important choice because the user could choose a cheap gas price and that can make the transaction times very long and can also result in a transaction getting stuck, which means that it gets broadcasted to the network, but they didn't set a high enough gas price to incentivize the miners to pick it up. And then in the case that it's stuck, the user now needs to replace that transaction with a transaction that has a higher gas price or a different transaction to kind of nullify it. Then, they could choose a higher gas price, but that obviously costs them more money. It's a very sensitive thing where the user is trying to balance, not getting a transaction stuck, not having a super long time until the transaction's mined, but also not paying, overpaying for their transaction just for the sake of, guaranteeing that it gets in. So what we did is took a step back and said, okay, instead of the user just signing a single transaction with a single gas price, we can have them sign a spectrum of transactions, starting with the market gas price and then slowly ramping up the gas price in each transaction in the set. So the user signs all of these transactions. They all share what's called a nonce, which is the transaction number, meaning that only one of these transactions will ever be mined. So they know that even though they're signing, say 20 transactions in the spectrum, only one of them's going to be mined. So it's no extra risk on their half. And then what we can do is then take that spectrum of transactions, broadcast the first one, check to see if it's mined. If it's not mined, we can automatically ramp up the gas price till it gets mined. And in that way, we know that we found the user the best gas price possible. And then we also know that that transaction will never be stuck. Now that we've solved that problem, now we don't need to present the user with that choice up front, that extra like cognitive load. We can just let them transact. And then after the transaction has been mined, we tell them, this is the transaction fee that was incurred. You know, we can that transaction fee could be paid in DAI, so it could be like, hey, you know, you paid 15 cents for this transaction, and it just works, and the user can trust it. Advanced users will be able to, you know, have fine grain control over their gas price. But for the mainstream user, we think this is a much better experience.
Part of that is an issue that might come up with that is relayers choosing the highest gas price, which has been an issue for some chains. So how would you combat that?
Yeah, so what we've talked about is allowing to incentivize the relayers to not just broadcast the highest gas price, is to kind of cater their reward so that the higher gas price that they use, the lower the fee that they're able to collect. So for our relayer, we just break even. So we don't charge the user any fee to use the relayer. For our relayer, there's no incentive to use a higher gas price because we're collecting zero fees anyway. But we also want the users to be able to use a network of relayers so that they don't rely on us. And that's part of that censorship resistance. And so to implement gas spectrum transactions with the decentralized relayer network, what we can do is make it so that the relayer is incentivized to use the lowest gas price as possible, because that means that's the highest fee that they'll collect. And then what we can also do is, make time-based incentives so that, you know, now the relayer is starting to think, you know, I say in quotes because they can automate this all, you know, using, software so that it just happens automatically. But the relayer can try to get, you know, the lowest gas price that will be mined in 5 minutes, say. You know, and so we can set those incentives up and have really fine-grained control of those incentives so that, just to line the incentives up. And then the relayer just tries to get the highest fee for themselves, which in turn is the best transaction for the user.
And how would you address guaranteeing that a relayer will pick up the transaction?
We can't guarantee that the relayer will pick it up, but what we can do is let the user know immediately whether they will or not. And so the way we do that is the user sends the transaction to the relayer, and then the relayer broadcasts the transaction, but also immediately returns the signed transaction to the user. And then that way the user can broadcast the transaction if the relayer doesn't. And they don't need to wait for the full block confirmation time to know that the relayer did in fact make their transaction.
So essentially how a user can pay fees and DAIs, they pay the relayer in DAI, but the relayer itself still has to pay in ETH. Is that mm-hmm. how it works?
Exactly.
And is there only one relayer, or how does the gas spectrum network work?
Well, there's a gas station network, and then we have our own relayer, which is actually a set of relayers. The default experience is to use our relayer. Again, you know, it doesn't, it's the cheapest option for the user because it just operates at cost. And then it also has a nice feature that we call the transaction firewall, which I can get into in a little bit. And then the idea is the gas station network is the decentralized relayer network that the user can kind of fall back onto. And so that works that, you know, anyone can register as a relayer. And then the user, like through the kind of software that interacts with the gas station network, just chooses a relayer, sends a transaction over. They send the signed transaction back. And if it doesn't get picked up immediately, it just chooses a new relayer until it's successful.
Got it. Great. That's definitely way more efficient than just guessing an amount of ETH to set in a transaction fee. How does the user know? You said the user doesn't know what their fee is until after. Do they set a max of like it's not going to go over 5 cents or?
So we'll show them a predicted fee, and yeah, they can set a max as well. And then, and then they just kind of get the fee, kind of like when you get into a taxi, you know about what it should cost. But when you get to your destination, it might be a few dollars higher, it might be a few dollars lower, but you don't know until after it's complete. But you know that you know, if you're using like Uber or something, you know you got a good price and that it's fair.
So can you tell me a little bit about the transaction firewall?
Yeah, so the transaction firewall is built into our Relayer. And so, you know, just like we have these different DAP keys that are scoped to different applications, we know where those DAP keys were created, what device they belong to, what IP address. And so with our transaction firewall through our Relayer, we can layer in these Web 2 like security features. So if you've ever been to like a crypto exchange and logged in and it says, hey, you know, we don't recognize this device, go verify your email to so we know it's you. You know, what they're doing is, you know, they're looking at this information and making sure that, you know, that you are the user that you say you are. And we can do that with these DAP keys where if we see the DAP key being used out of the context that we expect it to be used, then we can block the transaction. And so, like, obviously, this is a form of censorship. You know, we could censor the user in this way, and being censorship resistant is one of our core values. So that, you know, allows us to censor specific DAP keys, but the user is, you know, has access to their admin key. They're always able to create a new key and then just bypass the Ethereum Relayer and go through, you know, a decentralized Relayer network such as the gas station network. From the user perspective, that would be abstracted away, and the language would be very clear about, you know, do I want to use, you know, Ethereum to relay this transaction or not? That's kind of how they see it.
Great. And so obviously you would only put the firewall towards malicious dApps or false applications. So jumping into dApps and how to integrate Ethereum into different types of dApps. So can you tell me about how a dApp developer can integrate Ethereum?
Yeah, right from the get-go, you know, we knew that developer experience is going to be really important for us to get adoption. And so we wanted building against Ethereum, even though, you know, it's really complicated with these different keys and broadcasting to the Relayer and all this stuff. We wanted to make building with Ethereum, you know, the exact same experience as building against any, you know, thing like MetaMask or something like that. And so what we've done is wrapped everything in what's called a Web3 provider. And then you can use that provider with any of the standard JavaScript libraries or other libraries such as Web3.js or Ethers.js. Almost every dApp is already built against Web3.js and or Ethers.js. And in that case, it's just two lines of code. You just import Ethereum and then instantiate it with Web3 and you're good to go.
Great. So I'm not too familiar with the development side, but would the Web3 provider be similar to an API? How it works?
It's almost like allows. Yeah, it's similar in that it provides a standardized API, so that these kind of JavaScript libraries can wrap that standardized API and offer like a very friendly API to the end developer. And so that's kind of what. That's like a very high level description of like what Web3.js and Ethers.js do in part.
Great. So the primary focus for developers to integrate Ethereum to their dApp is that's the web-based side. Can you tell me a little bit more about the mobile application side? Do you guys have anything in the works, like an SDK?
Yeah, so we'll be releasing SDKs for React Native initially, and then down the road for Kotlin and Swift for iOS. And so those will make it really easy to build, you know, native applications that you know, run on mobile devices or on desktop. And the user can just log right into Ethereum and start using the application.
Great. So talking about or going into adoption, what integrations do you guys have already, I guess, on dApps or other applications?
Yeah, so we have a bunch in the work, and we're going to be announcing them along with our launch in early February.
Great. So do you guys have a plan to launch a standalone app, or is this strictly for integration with different dApps?
So yeah, absolutely. We'll have a standalone app. Onboarding to Ethereum, you'll always be able to do without making any kind of download. But then once a user has a certain level of funds, we want to kind of nudge them towards downloading a native app, because that's going to be a more secure and fluid experience. So you can imagine, you know, once you've kind of like started using Ethereum and you're logging into your favorite dApp, you have the Ethereum native app. What we can do is you hit login on the native app, whether it's on mobile or on your desktop. You get a push notification. You click the push notification, and you'll be able to approve that login using a biometric like Face ID or your fingerprint.
Great. So it's similar to like something that Google has in place with the Google app and logging in. So it's just a way more fluid login experience.
Exactly.
Great. So you guys haven't been around for long. Most people are barely hearing about Ethereum. It's completely new. So, you know, you guys been around for about like 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next for you guys? So I know you guys have some launches coming up. What do you guys have planned?
Yeah, so we've been gearing up for our public launch. And so that will kind of be the first time that the public can come in and sign up for an Ethereum account without needing any kind of referral code. From there, you know, we're going to be really, you know, perfecting that developer experience, perfecting that user experience. And then, you know, once we feel like that's in a good spot, we'll be, you know, starting to think about, you know, these native SDKs, and then also looking at what else we can kind of offer to dApp developers in terms of allowing them to sponsor their users' transactions, allowing them to let the user pay in whatever their token is, and you know, giving them access to analytics, opening up a notifications API, and really making it the dApp experience just feel like normal applications.
Great. And for the viewers, I definitely recommend at least checking out Ethereum. Definitely a cool experience to be able to sign in on any different browser, use it as a hot wallet, and you can store different tokens, different digital assets. We're coming to a conclusion. If there's one thing that you want viewers to do or something you want to say, what would it be?
Love for you guys to check us out. Please give us feedback. You know, our development is driven by our users. So we're always listening. We're always building features that are requested. So if there's something you want to see, let us know and we'll make it. And then give us a follow on Twitter, at Ethereum. Sign up for our wait list. And then really excited for launch and would love to see everyone create an account and start using Ethereum.
Great. So they have some exciting demos on their Twitter. Everything will be linked down in the description down below. So it's ethereum.org. So in the beginning, I'll say we skipped your intro in your background. And I said we'll get to it in the end. For those of you that have stayed throughout the whole podcast, thank you for doing so. And this is where you get to learn about Chris. So Chris, can you tell us about yourself and your background?
Sure. So I first kind of learned about crypto. At the time, it was just Bitcoin for the most part. Around when I graduated in 2014, I lived with some people that were working and started the Bitcoin Club at University of Michigan and the College Crypto Network, which became Blockchain Education Network. So I did a little work for them. I moved to Boston at some point, did some iOS development and was kind of doing crypto stuff as a hobby. And then I you know, stopped doing iOS development, started Boston Ethereum Developers, and then co-founded a Ethereum development shop and auditing firm called Level K. And we started, you know, sourcing deals from the meetup, and then we kind of expanded to, you know, clients across the world, you know, works with some really cool teams in this space, built some really cool stuff. We audited, you know, a lot of the big projects in the space. And then, you know, that ultimately, you know, was my, you know, core kind of Ethereum experience. And then also, where I experienced, you know, all the troubles with like using these decentralized applications, and, you know, which led to us, you know, building out Ethereum.
Great. So going back to the auditing, so that was your segue into crypto, right?
Yeah. So with Level K, we started as strictly a development shop, and then we, you know, just got asked to audit by, I think it was POA Network was the first one to ask, and we actually told them no. We said that we weren't auditors, and they said, you know, we trust you guys. You know, we've seen what you can do, and you should do this. And so we did an audit for them. We did an audit for a few other people, and started getting some really good feedback. And so that's kind of like how we got into to auditing, just by chance. But it became, a big part of the business, and also opened up a lot of doors with a bunch of different teams.
Did you come across any like major bugs?
Yeah. So, we've caught plenty of critical bugs in different projects. And one of the bigger ones actually wasn't for an audit that we were doing, but one of my other co-founders, Authorium, Shane, and I discovered a vulnerability that was with exchanges. And so there was a new thing called Gas Token that was just kind of starting to get out. And what Gas Token allows you to do is spend gas and kind of store it so that you can use it later. What we discovered is that, when you withdraw from exchanges, you can actually have the exchange pay for the gas in order to mint a bunch of gas token. And this was, an attack that could be leveraged with exchanges that don't really require KYC for signing up and stuff, which is pretty rare at this point. But at the time, there's exchanges that were allowing that. And so what you could do is make a bunch of withdrawals for the exchange and basically have them pay for as much gas token as you want. And then, use that for cheaper gas prices or sell it on a gas token market. So that was a discovery we made, and we ended up working through public disclosure with a handful of exchanges, and was, overall a good experience kind of learning about how to kind of communicate these vulnerabilities and while not letting the wrong people get their hands on the vulnerability before the vulnerable party is able to fix it.
Great. And if you guys want, that's obviously a very interesting story. And if you guys want to learn more about the gas station network in general, I'll link down in the description below a talk from an Ethereum co-founder at DEF CON 5. Which talks about the gas station network. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. People can find you at WinfreeChris on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Great. And for those of you that are listening to the podcast, be sure to subscribe to This Week in Crypto anywhere you podcast, or if you're listening to the podcast itself, be sure to check out the video version on YouTube. And thank you, everyone, for listening. You can find all the links and resources down in the description below, and we'll see you guys next time.